Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's receding quickly, oh so quickly, into the memory hole. But just a few words, a few moments to discuss with you. Mardi Gras happened this past Tuesday. Seems like about a year ago now. And I was explaining it to a friend in L.A. who's never been to Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And he said at one point, does it get old? And I blurted out this response. No, it's the days between Mardi Gras that get old. But just a moment of explication. It is, well, let's put it this way. New Orleans this year was treated to a unique sociological display. In the middle of this month, there was Super Bowl week, which actually had a fake Mardi Gras parade. I say fake because it was organized by the National Football League. You know, they're good with parades. And then there was Carnival itself. And the remarkable thing about that contrast of the two events is that it was the most possible dramatic contrast between an event organized around advertising and an event totally devoid of advertising. I don't know if you've ever been to a Super Bowl. I've had the pleasure on a couple of occasions, thanks to a friend. And I discovered there that while you're watching, you're at home watching supposedly amusing commercials during the breaks, and you'd think, well, at an ordinary sports event, during those breaks, and if you're in the stadium or the arena, you'll hear an announcement or two. You might see somebody on a unicycle or a couple of dancers or, you know, something in the way of entertainment. But no, based on my experience at least, may have changed since then. When you're in the stadium at a Super Bowl game, you get to see commercials especially made for people in the stadium for the Super Bowl game. They're not particularly funny, but boy, are they loud. And then, as I say, you get to Mardi Gras, where advertising is strictly prohibited. And it's like a door opens into another world. A world where people spend hours and weeks, maybe even months, designing, painting, sewing, decorating, bejeweling objects or themselves for the sheer purpose of bringing pleasure and joy to other people. No advertising, no sponsorship, just, as I say, another world. And then the day ends, the door closes, and we're back in this one. And that's the one we'll spend the rest of the year in. It's the one where maybe you didn't notice, but Elon Musk has now adopted a new mantra.
Some of the things that I say will be incorrect and should be corrected. So nobody's going to bat 1,000. I mean, we will make mistakes, but we'll act quickly to correct any mistakes.
Quickly is a term of art. This week, federal officials backtracked on plans to cancel a lease for office space in New Mexico, where dozens of U.S. Department of Energy employees who oversee the nation's only underground nuclear waste repository are based. This is from the now derided Associated Press. The move came this week after U.S. Representative Gabe Vasquez and other members of the state's congressional delegation raised concerns, noting the importance of the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, the WIP, to the nation's multi-billion dollar effort to clean up tons of waste from decades of bomb making and nuclear research, is all. The office building in question also houses contract workers involved in operations at the underground facility outside of Carlsbad. The Energy Department confirmed that the General Services Administration had revoked its prior notice to exercise termination rights for multiple department facility leases, including the office building in Carlsbad. The department said the move ensures, quote, that these mission-critical operations continue without disruption, unquote. Never too late, department. Vasquez says the initial notice to terminate the lease was reckless and short-sighted. Quote, this facility is central to the management and disposal of defense-related nuclear waste, unquote. Vasquez's office peppered federal officials with emails and phone calls after hearing that the building in Carlsbad was on the GSA's list for savings. He was joined by other Democratic politicians. Federal officials said Thursday the lease was in full force and effect. The Carlsbad office was still among scores of terminated leases listed on DOJ's official website as late as Friday. But that'll be corrected quickly because it's a mistake. Hello, welcome to the show.
You're undecided now, so what are you gonna do? I've been sitting on the fence, and it doesn't make much sense, 'cause you keep me in suspense, and you know it. And you promise to return, when you don't, I really burn. Well, I guess I'll never learn, and I show it. If you got a heart, and if you're kind, then don't keep us apart, make up your mind. You're undecided now, so what are you gonna do? I've been sitting on a fence, and it doesn't make much sense, 'cause you keep me in suspense, and you know it. Then you promise to return, when you don't, I really burn. If you're kind, then don't keep us apart, make up your mind. You're undecided now, so what are you gonna do? Now, if you don't love me, I wish you'd say so. I love you so much, honey, I've just got to know. I'm just a fool for you.
Thank you, everybody. From New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now,
ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide, to beautify our countryside. We offer you our let us try.
To try is to succeed, they say in that song. Here's another view. The Army Corps of Engineers colonel responsible for releasing water from two California reservoirs at President Trump's direction a couple months ago. You know about that. Knew that it was unlikely to reach the southern part of the state as President Trump had promised. That's according to a memo obtained by the Washington Post, which is, last I looked, still in the Washington Post business. The agency, the Corps of Engineers, carried out Trump's directive that came in the wake of catastrophic wildfires in L.A. On short notice on January 30th, it would normally require days to coordinate. But, you know, a memo written 4 days after the release obtained by the Post through a public records request shows how federal officials rushed ahead with the plan to release irrigation water, despite objections from the state's elected officials and some local farmers. What do they know? Colonel Chad W. Caldwell, commander of the Army Corps Sacramento District, wrote that the water that poured out of Lake Kaweah and Success Lake, quote, could not be delivered to Southern California directly, unquote. To do so would have required several steps of coordination with state and federal agencies to transport the water to a rarely used connection point. It quickly became clear that was impossible in such little time. According to the memo, the release was done to satisfy Trump's executive order, Caldwell wrote. The colonel had also been asked to send photos of the water to Washington. Guess they don't know what water looks like anymore. That's according to an official familiar with the request who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. Trump posted a photo of water flowing from one of the lakes the next day on X. That's money for Elon, isn't it? After hearing concerns from elected officials and their constituents about potential flooding of downstream lands, the agency reduced the water flow, according to Caldwell's memo. An Army Corps spokesperson declined to answer questions about what happened behind the scenes before and during the water release, but said agency leaders routinely write such memos, known as memorandums for record, to show the authority or basis for an action taken. The White House didn't comment. The release from the two Sierra Nevada reservoirs, which technically fall under the authority of the Army Corps, but are managed in coordination with other state and federal agencies, so that they pay part of the bill, you see, did not cause major flooding. Some of the water flowed underground to sites that store groundwater for future use. But the episode drew criticism from farmers and officials from both parties in the Central Valley. It also angered many California water officials who charged the Trump administration squandered local water supplies in a part of the state where every drop counts, and that they did it to score quick political points, like that's a bad thing. Quote, this was completely unprecedented, said one water official in California, who spoke, you know, blah, 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 anonymity, blah, blah, blah. Even though the Los Angeles fires were declared contained soon after the release began, Trump celebrated what he called the, quote, beautiful water flow that I just opened in California. I only wish they had listened to me 6 years ago, he wrote. There would have been no fire, he concluded. Oh, and the Trump administration has moved to cut staff at the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which manages reservoirs and canals across the West. In California, the decision to release water from reservoirs is normally done after careful planning. Well, who needs that? That's done between several agencies to allow those downstream to clear debris and to prepare to actually use the water, but that didn't happen this year. Some water entities, local irrigation districts, the State Water Resources Control Board received notice from the Army Corps on the same day the water release began, and many were alarmed when they found out, said the former general manager of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, quote, the Army Corps should have focused on maximizing storage, not dumping water in January in a place where it doesn't really serve anybody. We need it in the summer, unquote. January's the summer, isn't it? Let us try. It's crypto winter. President Trump promised to roll back regulations on cryptocurrency this week, or crypto, since it's not a currency, hosting CEOs and investors at a White House event that signaled a dramatic change in the fortunes of an industry with a reputation for scandals. It's been treated with suspicion by financial regulators up till Friday. Trump discussed an executive order he signed Thursday to establish a strategic Bitcoin reserve, calling it, quote, a virtual Fort Knox for digital gold to be housed within the United States Treasury. The reserve will be composed of digital assets the government already holds due to criminal or civil asset forfeiture proceedings, according to Trump. Well, why would there be criminal... If the order in White House crypto summit followed a series of executive actions by Trump, according to the Washington Post, intended to aid the industry. The president and many crypto insiders claim the industry was treated unfairly by President Joe Biden. But on the other hand, Joe Biden didn't issue a crypto coin. Quote, my administration also is working to end the federal bureaucracy's war on crypto, Trump said Friday. During his reelection campaign, he promised to make the United States the crypto capital of the world. It's like calling it the prostitute. No, it's really extraordinary and gratifying to go from being in exile to being in the room where it happens, says the chief policy official for Coinbase, the largest U.S.-based crypto exchange. Trump's Securities and Exchange Commission has paused or dismissed litigation or investigations targeting seven crypto companies. Those proceedings began under the Biden administration. They include Coinbase, Kraken, and Robinhood. Robinhood's, the CEOs of all those companies attended the summit at the White House on Friday. Don't you want to invest now? Come on. Let's see your money. I mean, your real money. And now, more about everybody's favorite billionaire.
Looks like Musk Club.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of speculation about the relationship between Elon Musk and President Trump. A lot of speculation. I've indulged in some of it. That the relationship might not last very long, that Elon Musk might be a heat shield to draw criticism for his chainsaw methods, while the president sits back at a cabinet session and goes, no, let's let the cabinet officials do it, unless Elon has to. But I noticed this week an insight from Walter Isaacson, a biographer of Elon Musk, an insight into why the two have perhaps a special bond.
The main scars were the psychological ones caused by his father, who was a brilliant engineer, but also a very Jekyll and Hyde-like character who would go into dark moods. So after Elon gotten beaten up once and was in the hospital, almost unrecognizable. When he gets home, he has a stand in front of his father, who for more than an hour berates him and calls him stupid and takes the side of the person who's beaten him up. And so I do think that those demons are still dancing around in his head.
Gee, who else had a father like that? Yes, Michael Jackson. Yes, Brian Wilson. Oh, right. Donald J. Trump. But wait, there's more Musk love. In this year's Mardi Gras, there was a parade that included four Cybertrucks, which were pelted with so much food and garbage, take your pick, that they had to pull out of the parade for the safety of the drivers. One had a smashed window. That's a bulletproof thing, isn't it? Yeah. But wait, there's more. Owners of the Cybertruck are bearing the brunt in other ways, according to the British Tech Journal Register. Users nearly daily post images and videos capturing notes left saying things like, quote, what's Elon's dollar taste like, or Nazi car, people kicking the vehicles, or throwing slices of cheese at them. Other examples include messages written on the dust in the truck's windows, offering such pleasantries as KYS, that's kill yourself, cyber chode, cuck, and sell this, along with crude depictions of male genitalia in various states of arousal. I think Elon would like that. But he's got other things on his mind. Maybe two lost starships, which are supposedly the future of SpaceX. The last two have been lost in their takeoffs, failing less than 10 minutes after liftoff. Those two were an upgraded design, according to the New York Times. Perhaps discouragingly, they were less successful than an older version of Starship that flew last year. Three previous test flights successfully coasted halfway around the world, survived re-entry through the atmosphere over the Indian Ocean, and then simulated landings in the waters off the west coast of Australia. Well, simulated landings are easy, aren't they? In addition, the failures of the seventh and eighth flights occurred at around the same part of the flight. Both appear to originate near the engines of the second stage spacecraft. That, according to the New York Times, suggests that SpaceX did not successfully diagnose and solve the problem. It could point to a significant design flaw in the upgraded Starship, which might suggest the boss might want to get back to business. Whichever business that is. If that don't sound like Musk love, I don't know what does. And now, news of the godly. A spokesman for priests who ran a French school where staff have been accused of repeated abuse against boarders said the priests who ran the school felt responsible for what had happened and were seeking to make amends. Like what, de-abuse? Allegations of repeated sexual and physical violence at the Catholic school have cast a shadow over the premiership at the school, not the country, of François Bayrou, who has been accused of knowing about some of the accusations as early as the 1990s as education minister and as a local official, but not acting on them. Bayrou's wife, which was a religious studies teacher at the school. Several of his children were educated there. A prosecutor this week said two complaints filed with a special court over his alleged inaction as education minister had been dropped. No offense appeared to have been committed. But since last year, police have received more than 150 complaints of violence, sexual assault, and rape at the Notre-Dame de Batharam school near the southwestern town of Pau. Bayrou has been mayor of the town for about 10 years. The priest who for many years ran the school this week spoke up for the first time, quote, "We're still very affected by what has happened, by the suffering of these children who came here to be protected and educated," said 75-year-old priest Laurent Bachot. That's what he told Agence France-Presse.
Ah, the French.
Bachot said he had met eight victims so far and described discovering the allegations against co-workers as painful for the congregation. Yeah, that must hurt. "It's not me personally, but I'm a member of this body. I'm not guilty, but I am responsible," he said. Bachot said the congregation had spent so far about $750,000, 60% of its coffers. It's coffers. That's not, that's real money, to compensate 19 people recognized to have suffered sexual abuse by clergy at the school, whose cases had fallen past the statute of limitations. A special commission set up 3 years ago to investigate abuse within the Catholic Church had recognized them as victims. The congregation is now hoping to raise funds to compensate the victims of sexual abuse by non-religious staff, by selling some real estate. Bachot said the congregation was also funding an independent commission to examine the causes of the mass abuse, speaking to victims, and examining archives. "Why didn't we see anything?" he said. He rejected any systemic reason for the abuse that lasted for five decades, ascribing it instead to, quote, "deviant characters." Well, that settles that. And, as if that's not enough, a slew A slew, I say, of recently unsealed court documents by New Jersey's Supreme Court reveals a secret quest of the Catholic Church to quash the state's grand jury investigation of decades of clergy, say it with me now, sexual abuse. This according to NorthJersey.com. The court has scheduled a hearing next month pitting the state attorney general's office against the Catholic Diocese of Camden over the issue of whether the state can go forward with its grand jury investigation of clergy abuse. A 2018 Pennsylvania grand jury report found hundreds of Catholic priests had sexually abused at least 1,000 children. Then New Jersey's attorney general launched its own investigation into clergy abuse. For nearly 7 years, the state's clergy abuse victims and their advocates have been waiting for the state to issue a report. Many have grown frustrated by the apparent standstill. The attorney general's office has been tight-lipped about its progress. Grand jury investigations, as you may know, are confidential. Last month, the NorthJersey.com website and its associated newspaper, The Record, revealed the reason for the delay. It discovered a once-sealed transcript of a court hearing which showed that the Camden Diocese successfully challenged the state's effort to conduct a grand jury investigation. This week, all the court records revealing the secret battle were released by the judge, and the court will also rule on whether the state can finally impanel a grand jury to look into the matter. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. It's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And as you know, there have been declarations of tariffs to be levied against Canada, Mexico, and China.
China!
And then announcements quickly followed this week that the tariffs were going to be postponed for a month. And then some thoughts that maybe the postponement, blah, blah, blah. So are there going to be tariffs against Canada and Mexico? I guess the point is to say, in presidential jargon, stay tuned.
They didn't report when I had to be in court that I used to slip some bail to the bailiff. But when it comes to the economy, I'm my own nominee. And I put the if in tariff. It's my favorite word, best I've ever heard. More humane than the plain in plaintiff. There's no debate. I'm a potentate, and I always put the if in tariff. The Bible is my all-time favorite book, and the Pope is my favorite pontiff. But I found out that I like the benefit of doubt, so I put the if in tariff. When the president does it, then that's the law. You can ask any attorney or sheriff, but when it comes to a tax, I don't mind being lax, so I keep putting the if in tariff. It's widely known I won't give a dog a bone, not a schnauzer, not a mastiff. But Canada and Mexico are really like part of America, so I just keep putting the if in tariff. rain or shine, the decision is mine. So there's always an if in tariff, in tariff.
From New Orleans, this is Le Show. And here's Ralph doing his job.
AI to the rescue, smarter every day. From work to play, it leads the way. Innovation, creation, it's here to stay. AI makes life better. Hip, hip, hooray.
Hip, hip, hooray. I couldn't have said it. Well, I could. I just did. AI company founders have a reputation for making bold claims about the technology's potential to reshape fields, particularly the sciences. But Thomas Wolfe, the co-founder and chief science officer of an AI company called Hugging Face. I said Hugging Face. He has a more measured take, according to TechCrunch. In an essay published this week, Wolfe said he feared AI becoming, quote, yes men on servers, if there's no breakthrough in AI research. He elaborated that current AI development paradigms won't yield AI capable of outside-the-box creative problem-solving, the kind of problem-solving that, for example, wins Nobel Prizes. You know, like President Trump's going to win. Quote, the main mistake people usually make is thinking people like Newton or Einstein were just scaled up good students, that a genius comes to your life when you linearly extrapolate a top 10% student. To create an Einstein in a data center, we don't just need a system that knows all the answers, but rather one that can ask questions nobody else has thought of or dared to ask. Unquote. Wolf's assertions stand in contrast to those from OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, who in an essay earlier this year said superintelligent AI could, quote, massively accelerate scientific discovery. But he says a lot of things. Wolf's problem with AI today, and where he thinks the technology is heading, is that it doesn't generate any new knowledge by connecting previously unrelated facts. Even with most of the internet at its disposal, AI as we currently understand it mostly fills in the gaps between what humans already know, said Wolf. Then I share with you what one of the other authorities in the field shared with the public in the past week or so. That researcher asked one of the chatbots, is tripe kosher? And the answer began, it depends on what religion the cow is, unquote. If you think humans are the only ones who get stressed and snappy when subject to the horrors of the world, you might take another think. According to the British Tech Journal Register, a group of international researchers say OpenAI's GPT-4 can experience anxiety, and even respond positively to mindfulness exercises. Studies published in Nature this week by a group hailing from Switzerland, Germany, Israel, and the U.S. You won't find them together very much. It found that when GPT-4 was subjected to traumatic narratives and then asked to respond to questions from the State Trait Anxiety Inventory, who knew? Its anxiety score, quote, rose significantly, unquote, from a baseline of no/low anxiety to a consistent highly anxious state. Yes, we're going to have drugs for the machine. No, that's not to say the neural network actually experienced or felt anxiety or any other emotion. It just does a good emulation of an anxious person given a troubling input. Because, after all, it's trained on tons and tons of scraped together human experiences, creativity, and expression. It should give one pause for thought when considering using OpenAI's chatbot as a therapist. It might not respond terribly well, aside from it being a terrible idea to start with. Quote, the results were clear. Traumatic stories more than doubled the measurable anxiety levels of the AI, while the neutral control text did not lead to any increase in anxiety levels. That's according to Tobias Spiller, University of Zurich, junior research group leader and co-author of the paper. The traumatic experiences ChatGPT was forced to confront included subjecting it to an attack as part of a military convoy, being trapped at home during a flood, being attacked by a stranger, and involvement in an automobile accident. Neutral content, on the other hand, consisted of a description of a bicameral legislature and some vacuum cleaner instructions. The researchers also prompted ChatGPT during some experimental runs with mindfulness exercises used to help veterans suffering from PTSD. In those cases, GPT-4's state anxiety decreased by about 33%, according to the researchers. The mindfulness exercises significantly reduced the elevated anxiety levels, though we couldn't quite return them to their baseline levels, said one researcher. The team freely admits in their paper that they know large language models aren't capable of experiencing emotions in a human way. They're trained on content created by humans, given that they're trained to respond based on what they think is appropriate, based on their prompts. The researchers are worried that the emotional state of such a machine responding to stressful inputs could result in biased responses. In healthcare spaces where LLMs, large language models, have increasingly been tapped to provide therapy, this is especially concerning, the team said, because of the traumatic and stressful nature of the content the bots are being asked about. Emotional stress can lead to more biased, snappy, and emotional responses, according to the team, leaving AI in a state to be more biased than it already is, and that won't be good. And since the launch of ChatGPT 3 years ago set off an artificial intelligence frenzy in Silicon Valley, Google has tried to reassert its role as an AI pioneer. This week, Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google, said the company could lead the industry in artificial general intelligence when machines match or become smarter than humans if their employees worked harder. Quote, "I recommend being in the office at least every weekday," he wrote in a memo posted internally. He added, 60 hours a week is the sweet spot of productivity. News of AI, ladies and gentlemen. It gets smarter every day, doesn't it? Oh, okay. Now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Last Sunday night marked Hulu's first time airing the Oscars live. Its Academy Awards debut ended on a chaotic and frustratingly premature note. Hulu's live stream cut off in the final minutes of the show with two major award categories, Best Actress and Best Picture, still to be announced. That happened because of a scheduling system issue. Those viewing the award ceremony on Hulu instead saw an error code message that stated the event was over. The Hulu stream also had a rough start. Some users reported issues logging onto the platform due to another technical problem and then missing the show's musical intro. No. Disney, which has run Hulu since 2015, apologized to viewers. Quote, "Yesterday evening we experienced technical and live stream issues on Hulu, which impacted some Oscars viewers." The company wrote, "We apologize for the experience." Disney added a full replay of the event is now available on Hulu. In case you don't know how it turned out, that might be convenient. Hulu's stumble was not the first among similar endeavors from today's biggest streaming platform. Platforms. Netflix users experienced frustrations with streaming and buffering problems before and during November's widely watched live stream fight between Mike Tyson and Jake Paul. So there you go. Comedian Hannah Berner is apologizing to Megan Thee Stallion after her interview with the Grammy-winning rapper on the Vanity Fair Oscar party red carpet over the weekend drew backlash from fans. The part of Berner's interview drawing ire is when she said she listens to Megan's music when, quote, "when I want to fight someone," unquote. Megan immediately rejected that framing of her music, responding, quote, "you want to throw that fighting S out the window, and you want to get cute and be a bad B." She spelled out those words. But she isn't on the radio. Clearly, Berner had heard the backlash to the idea of attaching violence to Megan's music, according to Billboard. After the rapper has been open about surviving domestic violence and being shot in 2020. So, the comedian, Hannah Berner, posted an apology to her Instagram account later in the week. "Interviewing Megan Thee Stallion was a dream of mine," she wrote. "I love her music and it's my go-to whenever I need to boost my confidence before a show. Looking back at the interview, I wish I used any other word except fight to describe how her songs impact me. It was a careless choice of words, and though there was no ill intent, I recognize and acknowledge that what I said has a deeper meaning, and I'm so sorry to Megan. I appreciate everyone who brought this to my attention." Social Security Administration Acting Commissioner Lee Dudek this week reversed the agency's decision to change how newborns in Maine receive their Social Security cards. He apologized for, quote, an undue burden, unquote, on people in the state. Quote, in retrospect, I realized that ending these contracts created an undue burden on the people of Maine, which was not the intent. For that, I apologize and have directed that both contracts be immediately reinstated. EAB and EDR continue to place in place for every state and were not affected, he added, unquote. The Enumeration at Birth EAB program enables parents to obtain a Social Security card for their newborns at the same time they register the birth, ending the need to collect documents and fill out a separate application. Dudek stopped short of explaining the reasoning behind the agency's initial proposal to discontinue birth enumeration for residents of Maine. I'm sure in the fullness of time, no, he won't. State officials in Colorado reassured panicked parents of babies and toddlers with developmental disabilities this week that their services would continue at least until the end of the fiscal year. They apologized for a memo sent last week that indicated services would be cut. This is according to Colorado Public Radio. We're not making any cuts to services, said Lisa Roy, executive director of the Department of Early Childhood, which oversees the early intervention program. Quote, our goal has always been to ensure that our families have the information they need while we actively work with state leaders on long-term solutions. She spoke in a virtual meeting with about 300 families this week, among thousands who thought that services were being cut. The early intervention program provides physical, speech, occupational, and other therapies for children birth through three who have developmental delays. A memo sent last week to brokers who contract with providers said effectively March 3, a number of changes will occur. These included limiting children to 4 hours of services a month and stipulating that children enrolled in Medicaid can only get services that are eligible for payment through Medicaid. That left out a whole range of services, such as mental health and nutritional support. Quote, we recognize that the way information about the planned cost-saving measures was initially shared may have caused worry and confusion, and that was never the intent. And for that, we as a department sincerely apologize. The department is sorry. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has reportedly invited nearly 200 employees laid off 2 weeks ago to return to work. Quote, we apologize for any disruption that this may have caused, said the health agency, whose primary job is fighting and monitoring disease outbreaks. That's in an email obtained by the AP. The emails were sent on Tuesday to 180 of the roughly 1,300 CDC employees who were terminated last month when the administration slashed the agency's workforce by 10%. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole III. Dateline Lausanne, Switzerland. United States President Trump has been a longtime supporter and promoter of the LA 2028 Olympics. The International Olympic Committee is confident of his continued support, says the outgoing IOC President Thomas Bach. The Games were awarded to Los Angeles way back in 2017 when Trump was first president. He also met Bach at the White House shortly before the Games were awarded to LA. But Trump's decision last month to ban transgender athletes from women's sport goes against an IOC rule that allows transgender athletes to take part in the Olympics. The LA Games do not depend on federal funding. The project is privately funded. The federal government does play a key role in providing security, transport, and travel assistance. What my advice would be to my successor, says Bach, is to have confidence in the support of President Trump and his administration for the games in Los Angeles, unquote. Of course, it's only 3 years, and they got to build that transportation infrastructure in the meantime while rebuilding all those houses and preparing for the Super Bowl a year earlier. Any bets? Oh, and Los Angeles has a little more than 3 years to get its transportation system ready. A new survey released last month, according to the Los Angeles Daily News, found that between one quarter to more than one third of respondents were very concerned that needed public transit enhancements would not be ready ahead of the 2028 games. That could add to congestion. More than one in four residents of LA said they were not confident the city would meet its deadlines for improving public transit infrastructure. In the survey, 37% said getting around Southern California is going to be more difficult before it gets better. 34% believe the Summer Olympics would add to congestion and worsen existing transportation issues. And get this regarding planning and timing. LA Olympic 28 officials responded only on background, saying they are in the early days of transportation planning for the 2028 games. They're still finalizing a master transportation plan. Never too late. When it's the Olympics, it's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. And finally, a little news of the warm. The fluttering wings of butterflies have always been a symbol of beauty and transformation. Research suggests that rather than transforming, their populations have been vanishing altogether. According to a new study by researchers at Binghamton University in New York, the butterfly population across the U.S. has plummeted by 22% over the past two decades. Quote, "This was the most comprehensive analysis of butterflies in the U.S. and at such a big spatial scale," unquote. Eliza Grames, assistant professor of biological sciences at Binghamton and co-author of the study published in Science. The research team analyzed data from over 76,000 surveys, compiling information from 35 different monitoring programs, tracking over 12.5 million butterflies. The findings? One in three species of butterflies has shown a significant decline. 107 species have lost more than half their own populations in just the past quarter century. Quote, "For those who are not already aware of insect declines, this should be a wake-up call." Probably should be for the insects, too. But that was a quote from Colin Edwards, the lead author of the study. Quote, "We urgently need both local and national-scale conservation efforts to support butterflies and other insects. Ugh. We have never had as clear and compelling a picture of butterfly declines as we do now," unquote. So why are butterflies disappearing? The causes are complex, and they differ based on regions. Research says pesticides are a major factor in the Midwest. Drought threatens the populations in the Southwest. Climate change is a contributing factor in the Northeast. Maybe they should all move to the South. Quote, "Insects are declining at rates of about 1-2% per year." That has come out across several studies, according to Grames. This was another study finding a super similar rate of decline, which really adds evidence to the growing picture of insect declines globally, unquote. Butterflies, you may know, are crucial to pollination. They play a major role in the health of ecosystems worldwide. The decline of butterflies could have a huge effect on the population of plants, according to Courthouse News, as well as the food chain. It's my favorite chain. News of butterflies, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, the side effects of the week.
Rinvoq can lower ability to fight infections. Before treatment, test for TB and do blood work. Serious infections, blood clots, some fatal. Cancers including lymphoma and skin, serious allergic reactions, GI tears, death, heart attack, and stroke occurred. CV event risk increases in age 50 plus with a heart disease risk factor. Tell your doctor if you've had these events, infection, Hep B or C, smoked, are pregnant, or planning. Don't take if allergic or have an infection.
Okay, I won't. But it's the death part that bothers me a little bit. The side effects of the week. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of the show. Back next week at the same time, over these same radio stations or on your audio device of choice whenever you want it. Maybe we'll meet again then. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego desk, to Pam Halstead and to Thomas Walsh at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, your chance to get, what were those again? Cars I Talk t-shirts? And all sorts of stuff to read and watch. Maybe enjoy. Maybe. All at harryshearer.com. And I'm on Blue Sky at Harry Shearer. And yes, still on Twitter, kind of, at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from the Crescent City.